Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us on this Wednesday of Holy Week, also called Spy Wednesday. Tomorrow, Holy Thursday, then Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and then Easter, of course, Sunday. So lots of stuff going on. But we're glad to get to be here with you today. It'll be open forum, and Jimmy's here with us today just to come in a day early because we'll be preempted on some stations, on the EWTN network stations tomorrow, although there will be some Holy Thursday stuff available and Good Friday stuff available on our app and on the internet, various internet places that you can get the program. So we'll be here in one way or another for the rest of the week. If you want to call today, open forum, 888-318-7884. Open forum means open to anyone, and you can ask anything you want. And I say that with great confidence because Jimmy is here. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Sarah Kellett.
Thank you very much for coming in a day early and do this with us. I mean, I know every time I say thank you to you, you remind me that you love doing radio.
But I do love doing radio.
We do appreciate it.
This time you reminded me.
Yeah. and you still love doing radio, right? That hasn't changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, anyone who would do 6.5 hours with, and that's not radio, that's podcast, but, you know, broadcasting
same
of some
thing.
Sort. Yeah. With Matt Fradd. 888-318-7884, the number. Actually, just one line open now. Jimmy, Friday, you'll have a program drop on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
As always, yeah.
And it'll be?
It's going to be a weird questions one. So you get a starring role in it. And
yay.
It covers questions like, should Elrond have killed Isildur? Understanding the Divine Mercy Chaplet? Reports of time travelers from the future? Teleportation clones and confession? Gulf War Syndrome, Klingon Baptism, Ancient Egyptian Spelling Bees, and more.
Ancient Egyptian Spelling Bee cracks me up. Squiggly Line, Rabbit Hawk. Oh, I'm sorry. No, you misspelled that one. The number here, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Sometimes I watch those Egyptian shows. I like Egyptian shows on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a thing called a cartouche. Is that the thing where it's like somebody's name, but it's just a mark?
It's not anybody's name, and it's more than just a mark. So a cartouche is the name given in English and French to it looks kind of like a long oval.
Yeah.
It's written around the name of a pharaoh. It also has a vertical line at one end of the oval. And when Napoleon conquered conquered Egypt, he brought a bunch of scholars with him to study basically early Egyptology.
Yeah.
It was all the rage in Europe, but people didn't know a lot about Egypt. So he brought all these scholars with him to study Egypt. And the French soldiers who conquered Egypt for him looked at these symbols on the wall. They didn't know how to read them, but they could see there's this oval-like circle around some characters. They didn't know it was Pharaoh's names at the time, but it is. And they thought they looked like cartridges, like you'd put in a rifle. And so the French word for cartridge is cartouche. And so that's how they came to be called cartouches. They only go around Pharaoh's names, and they are a magic circle of protection to protect the Pharaoh from harm and bad magic and things like that.
I don't know why I knew you'd know, but I knew you'd know that. I think I do know why I knew you'd know. You know a lot of Egypt stuff. Jimmy knows a lot of stuff. If you've got a question about stuff, stuff is one of the things he likes to talk about. 888-318-7884. We'll start in Texas today. John's in Texas watching on YouTube. Welcome, John. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Mr. Akin. My question today is, how would you go about rebutting the soteriological argument from evil? And I can read you the premises real fast. Premise one, if God is all loving, then he won't allow anyone to be damned if it's possible for him to save them. God allows some people to be damned, even though it's possible for him to save them. Therefore, God is not all loving.
Okay, well, this is just a in terms of the principles to resolve this, it's basically a version of moral evil, of the problem of moral evil. Why does God allow moral evil to exist? And then loss of salvation, going to hell and so forth, that's just the end point of committing moral evil. So the solution to this is going to be the same as the solution to why would God allow moral evil to exist. And the leading proposal on that is in order to allow free will. God apparently likes free will of a certain type. You know, free will can be understood different ways, but apparently God likes a type of free will where people have the liberty to either choose good or choose evil without him forcing them to choose one over the other. And so God then would allow them to experience, if they choose evil, he would allow, and they don't repent, he would allow them to experience the natural consequences of what they've chosen. If they've chosen to turn their back on God and reject his offer of eternal happiness and love, then he'll allow them to have a lack of eternal happiness and love. In terms of why God prefers this kind of free will, it would seem that God, we know God's primary motivator is love. That's why it's the first two commandments, love your God and love your neighbor. And consequently, it would seem that God allows free will in order to allow love to be freely chosen. And it would seem that if love was not freely chosen, then it would lack something, kind of like in the Ira Levin novel and later TV movie, The Stepford Wives, where there are these husbands who have a genius roboticist in their midst, and they're not entirely happy with their own wives, so they gradually knock them off and replace them by robots who act like perfect wives that are always loving. But this is a creepy novel, so you get the sense this isn't real love. This is just programmed behavior. Real love needs to be freely chosen.
Okay, John?
How would frustrating if someone asked, well, why God created, he knows will freely reject him? Why would he just create people he knows will freely, not force, but free?
Oh, I think I understand, John. It's hard to hear you, but you got the question, Jimmy, I think.
Yeah, I would suggest, because we're coming up on the break, I've written about that in substantial detail. And if you Google Jimmy Akin, why would God create someone he knows is going to go to hell, then you'll come up with an article on my personal website, jimmyakin.com, where I go into the different options to explain that, and I explain my preferred option.
John, thank you. Let's take that break. 888-318-7884, our number. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, right back after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilino with a few words about St. Ignatius of Antioch. St. Ignatius was one of the first Christians to leave a body of written work. His seven letters are like windows into the life of early Christianity. They show us a church centered on the Eucharist, with the clergy of bishops, priests, and deacons looking to authority in Rome, worshiping Jesus as true God and true man. Sound familiar? Well, it should.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And if you've got a question about the Catholic faith or anything else, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. And off we go to Newfoundland, Canada. Colin is listening on Catholic.com. Welcome, Colin. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks. Might be calling for a bit of speculation, but why would God choose to reveal himself using the category of God when other gods from the ancient world seem so different to him in terms of their nature, i.e. they're finite beings they're not the basis of all reality? So what sort of commonalities would there be between the category of El outside of Israel with the true God? And I have listened to Mysterious World 112, but I didn't feel like I found the answer there yet.
Okay. Well, so God communicates himself in human language, and he kind of needs to, because that's how humans communicate. And so when he chose ancient Israel to be his people, he needed to communicate with them in a way that they could understand. And so he used Hebrew vocabulary to do that. And in Hebrew vocabulary, the term Elohim has a range of meanings. It does apply to the supreme God who is infinite and the basis of all reality. It also was applied to foreign deities like Baal or Ashtoreth or Osiris or Zeus. And it also could apply to angelic beings who are sometimes referred to as the sons of God. And then it can even apply to departed human spirits. For example, in 1 Samuel 28, when Saul has the witch of Endor summon up the spirit of Samuel, in Hebrew it describes the human spirit of Samuel as an Elohim. And so Elohim seems to be a sort of category term in Hebrew that in biblical Hebrew applied to any inhabitant of the spiritual realm. Anything that is part of the spiritual realm could be understood as an Elohim, and that does apply to both the great God, the basis of all reality, and all of these lesser things too. Now, so that's, I think, a fundamental reason that God used that term for himself, because that's, it fit him, and it was an existing Hebrew term. It kind of wouldn't be as easy for God to teach the Hebrews an entirely new word and get them to think in terms of this entirely new word. So he just used a word that already existed. A second point that I'd make is God's revelation is progressive, meaning he discloses more about himself over time, over the course of biblical history. And so when he first began disclosing himself to the Israelites, they may have understood, okay, he's our God, and we need to worship him and him alone, but they may not have understood the full reality of what God is, that he's infinite, for example, is something that's not really clear in the Old Testament. It is clear that he's a creator, but it's not absolutely clear that he created the whole world out of nothing via his infinite power. And so those were aspects of God's nature and his relationship to the world that became clearer over time. And so initially, the Israelites might not have understood fully that their God is fundamentally different from all the other gods, but that was something God revealed to them over the course of history through his progressive revelation. So that may be a second reason why he used this term initially, and then he gradually educated them in terms of what it means when it's applied to him, as opposed to when it's applied to other supposed deities.
Thanks. That's a really good sum up of all that.
Thank you, Colin.
Could have a follow-up.
No problem. Yeah. Colin, did you just say, could I have a follow-up? I missed it.
I said if I could have a follow-up, I might ask.
Real quick, Colin.
Yeah. Why does God, use the category of the spirit world and all that? Does that actually have some commonality across all of these different religions in terms of what does that actually mean?
Well, so the category of spirit world does have commonalities across religions. Humans recognize that there is a fundamental duality to the cosmos. There's the visible part of it, and then there's another part which we can't directly detect with our senses, where our spirits exist and continue to exist in the afterlife, and there are other creatures besides just our spirits in that other invisible realm, including God and angels and things like that. So exactly what names are given to these beings will vary from one religion to another and one culture to another and one language to another. But there's a fundamental recognition of a duality to human nature and to the world itself. And the spirit world is one way of referring to the invisible part or non-sensory part of reality. And the physical world is one way of referring to the sensory part of the world that we can detect with the physical senses.
Again, thank you very much, Colin, for the call and the question. All the lines are full. On we go. It's open forum. Next up, Tyler in Ashland, Wisconsin, listening on Catholic.com. That's our website. Tyler, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right. My question is about the characters in the Book of Tobit. I heard we should read the story more like a parable instead of a historic event. So just wondering if the angel Raphael should be thought of as a more of a fictional character or a real angel that we can pray to in that.
Okay, well, so it's true that the Book of Tobit is basically an extended parable, and so we shouldn't regard most of the characters in it as being real, but just because most of the characters aren't real doesn't mean they all aren't real. And we have other evidence for Raphael, not in the Bible, but in other works of Second Temple period Jewish literature. So he's talked about elsewhere. Also, his name means God heals. And certainly God does heal. And since he uses angels in his administration of the cosmos, one could infer from that that there must be some angel involved in God's healing process. And since he's hierarchical, probably more than one, and since God operates in a hierarchical manner, there must be some chief angel in God's administration of healing in the world, and therefore there would be an angel corresponding to Raphael, who then also appears in these other examples of Second Temple literature and in the Book of Tobit.
Tyler, I'm going to keep going because, as I said, the lines have been quite full, and even as a line opens up, another one it gets filled immediately. So I'm going to go to Matthew in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Matthew, thank you for the call, and thank you for downloading our app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Si. My question is, how can we respond to Mormons or Unitarians who, when reading passages from the Gospel of John, especially that we would say support the divinity of Christ, would retort back and say, well, actually, those passages are referring to Jesus sharing in the same authority and power of the Father, but it nowhere near says that they share in the same essence.
All right, Matthew, thank you.
Okay. So you sort of asked two questions there. One is how to respond regarding particular passages that do proclaim Jesus's divinity in John. And I can't answer that because there's a bunch of them. And so one would have to respond to them individually on a case-by-case basis and show why they do support Jesus's divinity. In terms of how to respond to the claim that they simply refer to Jesus sharing divine authority but not the same essence, I would point to passages that are outside the Gospel of John that clearly indicate that there is only one God and that clearly refer to Jesus as God. You know, Paul does that, for example, and not as a God or something, but as God, and as equal to the Father, and also refers to the Father as God. So if you have, there's only one God, Jesus is God, the Father is God, and they're equal, that tells you they share the same essence.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. Thank you for the call. On we go to Johnny in Michigan. Hello, Johnny. Welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Blessed Holy Week. Blessed Triduum, and happy Easter to both of you gentlemen, and thank you.
Thank you, Johnny.
What's your question, Johnny?
I just have a comment. I wanted to say thank you very much for helping me in my spiritual journey. I've been helping out at my church when they need an extra help at hand at the collection. And last week, the usher captain asked if I would consider being a full usher and we were talking last night, and I am going to be a full usher now, part-time at my church.
Well, congratulations, Johnny. Well, that's great news. I'm glad that you found some help here in your spiritual journey, and that led to that. Thank you very much.
And just thank you, guys. I appreciate what you guys do, and I talk to you guys. I'm talking about you guys to the ushers at church that I listen to you guys.
Well,
so just thank you.
Well, that's very gracious of you to call back and say those things, Johnny. You're always welcome here whenever you've got a question, but also just to share good news. Thank you very much for that. And all of those things to you, including Happy Easter, Johnny. Thank you. Anthony's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, watching on Twitch. Anthony, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Cy and Jimmy. So I run into a lot of Orthodox people, and I've had to been doing a lot of apologetics. I often bring up the Orthodox idea of allowing divorce and remarriage multiple times, and I get either one of two reactions. One, they flat out deny that the Orthodox Church allows that, and you know, there's no kind of universal Orthodox catechism I can point to that shows that they do allow it. Or two, they try to justify it by saying things like, the Sixth Ecumenical Council ratified Basil of Caesarea's canons, and he allowed for divorce and remarriage. Therefore, it's allowed. And I found a really great Catholic Answers article from 2004 that shows all these early church fathers specifically prohibiting divorce and remarriage, how it's equivalent to adultery. But then they say, but that doesn't matter because the Sixth Ecumenical Council ratified Basil of Caesarea's canons, so therefore that doesn't matter.
Okay.
Okay, well, first thing is ecumenical councils are not infallible, except when they are. And so one would have to look carefully at the texts of the Sixth Ecumenical Council and see if they use their gift of infallibility with regard to Basil's canons. Then one would have to look at Basil's canons and see whether they really teach what is being claimed or not. I don't have that material in front of me, so I can't comment on that. But what I can say is you would need both the Ecumenical Council to be giving an infallible endorsement of Basil, and you would need Basil to actually be teaching what they're claiming that he teaches, and that it fits their own practice as opposed to something else. If those conditions are not met, then either Basil is talking about something different than what they're teaching, or Basil is not allowing remarriage in general, or the council didn't proclaim it infallibly. And if the council didn't, if those three conditions are not met, particularly if the council didn't proclaim it infallibly, then we can turn to another set of infallible documents that do address this question, and that's the New Testament. Because if you read Jesus's discussion of divorce and remarriage in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and 1 Corinthians and Romans, it does not allow for remarriage in following civil divorce in general. Now, there are the exceptive clauses in Matthew, and those can be understood in more than one way. But even in Matthew, it's not allowing people who've gotten divorced to just remarry willy-nilly. You could argue about, are there a few exceptions here? And we could talk about the nature of the exceptions, if there are even exceptions. They may not be. But the New Testament, which is an infallible collection of documents, is clear in like multiple places that one simply cannot get remarried after a divorce.
Anthony, I'm going to leave that one there and keep on because, as I said, the line's very, very busy today. And I'm sure that's connected to Jimmy being here with us, open forum. And Peter is in Vienna, Austria, watching on Facebook. Peter, very glad to have you here. Thanks for calling. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. So my question is, you often hear this kind of argument from Muslims, and I don't believe this, but they typically say that Adam was a Muslim, Noah was a Muslim, Abraham was a Muslim. And it got me thinking, what actually was their religion? Because they weren't Jews, right? And of course, they logically weren't Christians either. And we have Old Testament prophets, for example, who were also not Jews, like Job, for example. So how can we explain their communication or faith in God? Would they have a religion, or how would you describe that?
Yeah, they had a religion, and the ones like Job who worshiped God, worshiped God. They weren't Israelites, but you didn't have to be an Israelite to worship God. There were Gentiles who did that, both in the Old Testament period, like, for example, Naaman. And there were Gentiles who did that in the New Testament, like the God-fearers. In fact, even the Roman emperors would offer sacrifices at the Jewish temple. So you didn't have to be a Jew in order to be able to worship God.
I'm going to take a quick break. Well, you can hear the music. I got to take this quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's almost the end of March, and so I just want to mention again that there is a $150 off deal until the end of March, and then we don't know about cabins and what will be available after that, but we have to give the cabins that we have back to the cruise line. So if you want to come on the Catholic Answers Canada and New England cruise, June 29th through July 6th on the Holland America line, we would love it if you'd come. If you'd like more information and if you'd like to get that ticket before the $150 off deal goes away, now is the time to check it out. CatholicAnswersCruise.com. Use the promo code LAST150 because I think this is the last time we're going to give $150 off. I think that's why they did that promo code. So just use the promo code LAST150 at CatholicAnswersCruise.com if you sign up to come. And we hope you will. Let's go to Port Perry, Canada. And the only guy I know in Port Perry, Canada is Sean. Sean, welcome back.
And I'm listening on the echo dots. We're not allowed to say her name.
Yeah, don't say that other thing. Right.
Right. You know, when people call in and they start by speaking about how much they love your program and how much they've learned from it, it may sound disingenuous, but we all mean it from our hearts to you.
Oh, I take it that way, Sean.
We're so grateful because 5 nights a week, we welcome you into our homes. And even though you've never met me and you never will, I feel like I know you because I hear you several hours a week right in my house. So
well, thank you, Sean.
Thank you. The question that I have for Jimmy is with regard specifically to Matthew 7, verses 13 to 14. And this is the place where Jesus warns about the way to destruction being broad and the way to salvation being narrow. Mm-hmm. And when one thinks about the large numbers of Christians that there are in the world, not all of whom are just people who maybe go to church once in a while, but they don't really have faith. But the ordinary person who does take the faith seriously, assists at Mass, does something to help their neighbors, prays daily, asks God to show them what his will is for them regularly. There's still millions of us who do that. So if the way to salvation is narrow, how many of us are going to be left out?
Well, there are different opinions on this question, and the church hasn't addressed the matter in any infallible way. There, on the one hand, it is a permitted opinion to hold that the majority of human beings will not be saved. That's different than holding the majority of Christians will not be saved, and that's different still from holding that the majority of active, sincere, practicing Christians will not be saved. Another permitted opinion is that most people will be saved, and certainly that would entail that most Christians would be saved and most active practicing Christians would be saved. It's even permitted to hope, this is different than believing, but to hope that everybody would be saved. There are different ways of understanding the passages, like the one you mentioned in Matthew 7. Broad and narrow do not have to mean few and many. They can also be, although there is a passage in Luke that suggests that, but they can also be understood in terms of difficult and easy. It's easy to take the road to destruction. It's more difficult to take the road to salvation, but that doesn't tell us anything about how many people go down one path versus the other. Even in Luke, where Jesus applies the terms many and few to these, that doesn't mandate an understanding of greater than 50% is take the road to destruction and fewer than 50% take the road to that leads to life, because many just means many. It doesn't have to mean most. And so even that passage can be understood in more than one way. Also, Jesus is talking about the world in his day when the world was swallowed in pagan darkness. And he's not talking about the world in our day when the gospel has spread throughout the nations and a third of the global population is Christian and half the global population worships the God of Israel. So we're in a very different world than the one Jesus was talking about. So I won't go too much further down that path, but I would mention a couple of things as reference points for you. One of them is Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical on Christian hope, Spes Salvi. And in that, he proposes a fairly straightforward interpretation where he says, okay, we've got these three fates, heaven, hell, and purgatory. Very few people are ready to go to heaven straight away without some purification. But the large majority of people, in his view, still retain a fundamental openness to God and to love, even if it's covered over with a bunch of stuff that needs to be purified. And very few people have fully turned their back on God. And consequently, he proposes, he says, we may suppose, he doesn't teach this, but he says we may suppose that the majority of people are going to go to purgatory. A few will go directly to heaven, a few will go to hell, but he thinks the majority of people, meaning those going to purgatory and going to heaven, will ultimately end up be saved. There's also another article that I reference all the time on this question, and I recommend to everybody who's interested in this question to read it. It's by Cardinal Avery Dulles. It was published in First Things a number of years ago, and it's called The Population of Hell. So if you Google Cardinal, if you Google Avery Dulles or just Dulles and The Population of Hell, it will come up. And Dulles's opinion is that we don't ultimately know what proportion of people will be saved, because the data it can be read different ways. And he thinks that's actually a good thing. He thinks if we knew that that the majority of people are going to be saved, we would be tempted to slack off. And he thinks that if we knew the majority of people were not going to be saved, we would be tempted to despair. And so he views keeping us out of knowing the answer to this question is actually good for us. It encourages us to strive spiritually without despairing.
Sean, again, thank you for the kind words. Thank you for the question. It's nice to hear you again. And I hope that you will have a happy Easter up there in Canada. Adanya is next in North Dakota. Adanya, are you there with us?
Yes.
Well, hello. How old are you?
9.
9 years old. Well, thank you very much for calling us. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Aiken.
If you went back in time, could you pray for yourself so you didn't do a sin that you knew you did in the past?
Uh-huh.
So if you go back in time, okay, I've got to make a distinction to answer the question, I think, the way you mean it. It's going to depend on how time works. Either it's possible to change events when you go into the past, or it's not possible to change events. If it's not possible to change events, then it really wouldn't make sense to ask God to please keep me from committing a sin that I remember committing in the future. So let's say, you know, you commit a sin in the year 2024, but then you go back in time to the year 2023, you remember committing the sin in 2024. If it's not possible to change time, then it really doesn't make sense to pray about that, to ask God to change it. On the other hand, if it is possible to change time, then you could potentially pray that God intervene to stop you from committing the sin that you remember committing next year. But in that case, what's probably happening is you're causing the timeline to split in two. And you might be able to help an alternate version of you avoid committing the sin. But you yourself, in your own personal timeline, did commit the sin, and so you'd still need to go to confession for it.
Does that all make sense to you, Adanya?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. I'm glad you asked. You called and asked about time travel, and you did it on exactly the right day. You did a great job, too. Somebody's done a good job helping you to talk on the phone or teaching you to talk on the phone, and you can call here anytime. I have to take a break, however, so I will say excuse me, and off to the break we go, right back with more open forum questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on, we'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Catch up with the latest news from Washington, D.C., the Vatican, and the world on all of our EWTN news platforms, including EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, the Catholic News Agency, and EWTN News In Depth. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I should have asked Adonia if she follows Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It just seems suspect to me that she called with a time travel question when Jimmy was here. I think she...
Lots of kids wonder about time travel.
Yeah. But she knew who to call is what I'm saying. I was going to give out the number. I'll give out the number, 888-3187-884, but all the lines are full. It is open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Mark is in Toronto, Canada, listening on our website, catholic.com. Welcome, Mark. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy and Cy. So my question, it's about a terminology change for Good Friday. So before the retranslation in 2011, we had what was called the Veneration of the Holy Cross. And then after 2011, at least in all the English materials I've come across, we now call it the Adoration of the Holy Cross. And I was wondering about the terminology change, because it's a little confusing. I grew up being told that, at least in English, adoration generally meant what some people would call, you know, latria, or the worship due to God alone. Hence, mm-hmm. you go to adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. And so kind of the terminology change was confusing. So I was wondering if you could provide a little bit of context on the change and what's kind of going on.
Okay.
Well, so I'll take your word that there was a terminology change on this. That doesn't correspond with my memory of the liturgy before the new English version came out in the year 2010. My memory is that it's, as long as I've been alive, that it's and been aware of this, is that it's always been called the Adoration of the Cross. But assuming that my memory is inaccurate, and that, you know, it didn't vary from place to place, like maybe they translated it differently in Canada than in the United States, but assuming that it used to be veneration, what would have happened that it resulted in it being adoration is the Vatican mandated a more literal translation of the Latin. And in Latin, it does use the term for adoration. Now, it's common in English to explain, okay, veneration is something, is a form of respect or honor that is less than adoration, which is the respect and honor due to God alone. Those different categories, or they're, that may or may not reflect the semantic range of the term for adoration in Latin. It may have a broader range than it does in English. So that could be another reason why there's why the term adoration gets used in the Latin. However, personally, I think this is confusing. And if I were Pope, this is one of the minor tweaks I would make to the liturgy to eliminate the confusion. I would change the name in the Latin to the Veneration of the Cross to make it clear we're not giving the form of honor that is due to God alone to a piece of wood. And so I would change that just to eliminate potential confusion. But I understand the source of the confusion.
Mark, thank you. Thanks very much for the question. On we go. Jay is in South Florida watching on YouTube. Jay, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call, guys. My question is this. I'm a already baptized candidate in a different Christian tradition, and I'm becoming Catholic. I'm going through RCIA. I recently had my first confession, and the problem is, since then, I feel I may have fallen into mortal sin, and I'm now having trouble scheduling a confession appointment with anybody before when I'm scheduled to have my first communion and confirmation. And I know weekly mass you should not partake, but I kind of had two different answers from people in the church about this. One person said that, since it is your first communion and confirmation, go ahead and receive as long as you make a perfect act of contrition and plan to go to confession as soon as you can. And somebody else said, nah, even though it's your confirmation and first communion, do not receive. And I just wanted to see what you thought about that.
Okay, so I think three points need to be made. The first one is you need to clearly ascertain whether you really did or did not commit a mortal sin. And for a variety of factors, you should give yourself the benefit of the doubt. If you did not have all three conditions, meaning there had to be grave matter, you had full knowledge of the fact there was grave matter, and you gave deliberate consent and say, I don't care, I know there's grave matter here and I'm doing this anyway. If all three of those were not fulfilled, you did not commit a mortal sin and you should not be scrupulous about this. The second point is, even if you did commit a mortal sin, now you said you had trouble scheduling a confession. I would say, well, if you did commit a mortal sin, the preferred solution is to call a priest individually and schedule a time to get together with him, even if it's right before Easter Vigil. But that's the preferred solution. The third point is, if it's not possible to schedule a confession if you committed mortal sin, then what you were told about making an act of perfect contrition is correct. It is possible to make an act of perfect contrition with the intention to go to confession as soon as it's reasonable, and then go ahead and receive communion and other sacraments like confirmation. Canon law expressly permits that. But there has to be a grave reason why you need to do that. You can't just do this any old week. There needs to be some grave reason why you need to receive communion and other sacraments like confirmation now. And in this situation, there is such a grave reason. If you don't receive them now, it's going to mess things up. So you're, because of the scheduling of your reception into the church, this is exactly the kind of situation that creates a grave reason for you to receive these sacraments now. And therefore, it would be justified, if you can't otherwise get to confession, it would be justified for you to make an act of perfect contrition and go ahead and receive these sacraments. On the other hand, as I said, you may not have committed a mortal sin at all. All three of those conditions have to be fulfilled. And if you merely have a suspicion that you might have committed a mortal sin, then you should put that aside and not be scrupulous about it. Because if you've committed a mortal sin and there was that deliberate consent there, you ought to know that you committed a mortal sin. So those are the three points. Make sure that you really did commit a mortal sin. Don't just go on, I think I may have. You really need to know it. And then try to schedule confession. If you did, try to schedule confession. And if you're not able to schedule a confession before Easter Vigil, then make an act of perfect contrition and go ahead and receive the sacraments, and then go to confession as soon as it's reasonable afterwards.
Jay, thank you. I do hope that was helpful to you. God bless you. And
welcome home, dude.
Definitely. What a beautiful, joyful thing. Jay, thanks. I'm going to keep moving, because we don't even get a break with the lines. They're just staying full. Patrick's in St. Joseph, Missouri, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Patrick, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Great. Thank you, guys. And thank you for all you do. I find this, this app and everything so comforting and enlightening, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patrick. What's your question?
My question is, I was raised Lutheran, a baptized mm-hmm. Catholic, and in the Nicene Creed, where it says Jesus descended into hell, I was mm-hmm. always taught that it was like a victory tour, a victory parade to free the souls. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, two things. Judas, committed a mortal sin, I believe, when he hung himself, plus, of course, what he did before that. Is there anything written in the Catholic Church or anywhere that what did Jesus free Judas from hell? And also, what happened to the people that were in purgatory when Jesus descended into hell?
Okay, so in regard to Judas, there certainly have been many authors who have supposed that Judas did commit a mortal sin more than one and then went to hell. If that's what happened to Judas, then Christ didn't free him from hell. When the creed says that Jesus descended into hell, it's using the older meaning of the term hell. In English, hell didn't mean specifically the place of the damned. It just meant the place of the dead. So everybody in the old sense went to hell. But Jesus then descended into hell, meaning he died. He went to the place of the dead. And he did preach to the spirits who were there. We're told that in the New Testament. Exactly what he was preaching, we're not told. It could be he was announcing, I finally redeemed mankind, everybody, even to disobedient spirits, in which case it wasn't going to do them any good. And if Judas was among those spirits who were damned, then it wouldn't do Judas any good. On the other hand, he may have appeared to spirits who were saved, but in the place of the dead, and said, guess what? I've redeemed y'all now. Now we all get to go to heaven. In which case, those souls who were ready to go to heaven would go to heaven. If there were people who were not yet ready to go to heaven, but were still saved, you know, people who were being purified, then we don't know what would have happened with him. He could have either purified them instantly, like he'll do for people at the second coming, or he could have left them but in purgatory, but with the assurance that they would eventually be received into heaven once their purification was complete.
Great. No, thank you. Thank you for that answer. And you know, I'm thinking about converting to Catholicism, and as a baptized mm-hmm. Catholic that has never gone to a Catholic church, mm-hmm. what am I allowed to do? I don't know. Should I kneel? I don't kneel. I know
okay.
I can't take communion.
Let me make sure I understand your situation. So you were baptized Catholic, I'm guessing, as a baby, but then you were raised Lutheran. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. You can go to Mass and do everything except receive communion. You can do that all okay. right now. If your parish may have a custom where people sometimes cross their arms over their breasts and come up and get a blessing, you could do that. If they have that custom, the only thing you can't do is receive communion itself at the Mass. If you decide right. to come home to the Catholic Church, what you need to do is go to confession. And once you go to confession, then you could begin receiving the Eucharist. You also would need to get confirmed if you haven't been confirmed, but that wouldn't have to wait on, that could wait until after you've been to confession and after you've started receiving communion. So you don't have to do the sacraments in the ordinary sequence. You've already been baptized as a Catholic. To be reconciled, all you need to do is go to confession, and then you can receive the Eucharist. And then you need to see about getting confirmed at some point.
I see, because I was confirmed as a Lutheran. We did the small catechism. We went through the small catechism.
Yeah, it needs to be a Catholic confirmation.
I understand. Hey, well, thank you so much for your answer and clarifying that.
No problem. Hope that helps.
And Patrick, I don't know if you've got Jimmy's little book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. But I would like to send it to you. If you just hang on the line, we'll get an address for you, and we will send that off. Jimmy, if I could, before we just go to the break, I have a question, kind of follow up on Patrick's. Is there a time when you have to make a profession of faith? Is that in order to come in?
Not if you've already been baptized Catholic.
Oh, yeah, I see. But there is a time. Like, some people might be required to make a...
Yeah, if you're about to be baptized, you know, over the age of reason, you got to profess the faith. And if you're being received into the church from another tradition where you were baptized outside of the Catholic Church, then you need to profess the Catholic faith. And then they say the Lord receives you into his church, and then you're a Catholic. But those are for people who were not previously part of the Catholic Church.
Right.
If you have ever been Catholic, then you don't have to reprofess the faith in order to come back. You just got to go to confession.
Well, thanks. I knew there was some time when somebody had to make a profession of faith. But Patrick, what great news. It's delightful to hear. And I hope that you'll find that book helpful. And if you have more questions, please call back. I'm sure that any apologist here would be happy to answer them. We got to take a very quick break. So if you're on the line, just hang on the line. And I'll tell you what, if you haven't called yet, there's going to be one line open. So nice time to call, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum, and that means open to anyone with any question at all. 888 318-7884.